You are listening to the Pacific Northwest True Crime Podcast. On today's episode, we'll dive deep into the life of Oregon's most prolific serial killer, a person whose unusual upbringing led him down a dark path of obsession, leading to the torture, mutilation, rape, and brutal murder of 8 women. A man who would later become known as the Malala Forest Killer. And now, your guide down this twisted rabbit hole, Columbia.
Thank you to my wonderful editor and collaborator, Nye. I would like to welcome you and thank you for tuning into the very first episode of the Pacific Northwest True Crime Podcast. Our first episode will be on Dayton Leroy Rogers, also known as the Malala Forest Killer. Dayton's case is a unique one in that there's very limited information on him and his case. And what information there is on him and the case is mostly speculation or was simply just made up. The main source of information for our podcast has been from Gary C. King's book, Bloodlust, Portrait of a Serial Sex Killer. Gary has been a writer for over 30 years. He has published 19 books and written over 500 stories that have been published in various magazines in the United States, Canada, and England. He has a very reputable source. There is a reason why you can't find much on our subject, Dayton, and why the facts have never been set straight, which will be explained when I read the letter I received from Dayton himself at the end of the podcast. So, without further ado, let's dive into the murky, murderous waters of the life of Dayton Leroy Rogers. Dayton Leroy Rogers was born in Moscow, Idaho on September 30th, 1953, to Ortis and Jasper L. Rogers, who were both devout, zealous members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Ortis never liked or even wanted children, but Jasper L. loved children and had always dreamed of having a large family of her own one day. The church did not believe in birth control and believed in having as many children as God provided. Ortis complied with the church's teaching, and Jasper L. had the family she always wanted. Dayton had 2 older biological sisters, along with 3 adopted sisters and 1 adopted brother. Ortis was a strong believer in harsh punishment and strict discipline. Oftentimes, the punishments would leave the kids covered in bruises or bleeding. Sometimes it seemed there was no reason behind the beating or so-called punishment, and he never offered one. It was justified to him, and that's all that mattered. Part of Ortis's cruel behavior could be derived from his belief that the children all had evil in them, and he was trying to remove it through the harsh punishment and strict discipline, as well as through regular church attendance, frequent family Bible readings, and Bible studies, also having all of the kids attend Seventh-day Adventist schools. Ortis also implemented a strict censorship in the household. He became the judge over what they watched, listened to, and read, and then he deemed whether it was appropriate or not. One instance of Ortis's extreme censorship is when he used a black permanent marker to fully clothe the hula dancers on his Hawaiian records so that only the face and hands were exposed. When friends of his asked Ortis why he did this, he explained that the women on the albums were whores and he wouldn't tolerate pornography in his house, but that he did enjoy the Hawaiian music. He didn't want to toss the records, so he found a way to make it acceptable. Ortis often preached to the kids that women who had sex before marriage or who kissed on dates should be stoned, just like the whores in the Bible. Ortiz moved the family around a lot to follow jobs, sometimes up to 3 to 4 times a year. Another outlandish belief of Ortiz and Jaspero was that they believed Armageddon was near, and staying away from big cities was important because they were wicked, and of course, Armageddon would start in big cities. The family struggled financially and occasionally lived without electricity. At times, they lived in cars or trailers. At one point, the family lived in a chicken coop that Ortiz converted into somewhat of a house. Because of being forced into such close proximity to one another all the time, Dayton became interested in his sister's feet, and this is where his foot fetish started. He began to fantasize about his sister's feet. He evolved into stealing their shoes. Then he would eventually fantasize about their feet and masturbate with his sister's shoes. As much as Jaspero begged Ortiz to become close with Dayton, Ortiz wanted nothing to do with him. He never played with him, never bonded with him. Because of this, Dayton hated his father and rejected him and everything he stood for. Dayton resented his mother as well for siding with his father. At 16, Dayton had had enough of living with his father and dealing with the extreme censorship and the beatings disguised as punishments. Dayton dropped out of high school and moved to Corvallis, Oregon, where he found a job as a house painter. 3 years later, in July 1972, Dayton moved to Eugene, Oregon, and found another job as a house painter. He began dating a girl. A short while later, Dayton and the girl decided to get married. Dayton's parents became angry and immediately disapproved of the marriage, simply because she was Lutheran. No other reason. About a month after getting married, on August 25th, 1972, in Eugene, Oregon, Dayton and a 15-year-old girl he had been having an affair with were on a picnic date in the Eugene woods, laying on a blanket, when suddenly Dayton stabbed her in the stomach. She opened her eyes and asked him why he did that. He said, "I just couldn't trust you anymore." Her reply was, "Dayton, I love you." Shocked by her response, Dayton came to his senses and said, "Oh my God, what did I do?" Dayton then proposed to her, even though he had just gotten married less than a month prior. She said yes, then begged him to take her to the hospital. He would only take her if she promised to say she stabbed herself. Desperate to live, she agreed. While recovering in the hospital, the doctors confronted her and told her they did not believe that she stabbed herself. After the police promised they would ensure her safety, she confessed the truth, that Dayton was the one that stabbed her. After he was arrested, Dayton had his first psychiatric evaluation. He was found to be competent in that he knew right from wrong. However, the psychiatrist did note that Dayton fell into the classification of depressive neurosis, probably superimposed on a long-standing schizoid personality disorder, meaning at this point it was noticed that he was mentally unwell, but nothing was done for him. February 13th, 1973. Dayton pled guilty to second-degree assault, was sentenced to 4 years probation with no jail time and no prison time. 6 months after the stabbing, Dayton and his wife had let 2 teenagers who were runaways stay with them at their home. One night, Dayton became incredibly drunk and began kissing and fondling the 2 underage girls and asking for sexual favors. One of the girls tried to separate Dayton from his wife. This understandably upset his wife, who decided to leave and stay with 2 of her male friends. Sometime later, Dayton once again became excessively drunk and angry that his wife had left, and he went to go bring her home. Upon arriving at the friend's house, Dayton was in a drunken, angry stupor. A fight between his wife's friends and Dayton ensued. To appease Dayton and to end the fight, Dayton's wife agreed to return home. An important note to mention, it was around this time that Dayton began having violent fantasies when he drank. These fantasies became intertwined with sexual acts. August 1st, 1973, while his wife was out, a drunken Dayton attacked the two teenage girls with a beer bottle, beating them both severely. After his unprovoked act of violence, Dayton left his home in his 1967 white Camaro. The two girls were bruised, cut, and bloodied, but were able to call 911. Dayton was arrested close to his home due to the fact that when he fled the scene, he was still intoxicated. He collided his car with another. He was subsequently charged with second and third degree assault. I am unsure why he was not charged with a DUI. At this point, a second psychiatric evaluation was ordered. After the stabbing incident, and now the beer bottle attack, Dayton's wife had become scared of him, and in an effort to protect herself, she threw out his gun and all of the sharp knives in the house. Upon discovering this, Dayton became enraged with his wife, but he did not act upon his anger, probably due to the fact that there was pending charges against him. In September and October of 1973, Dayton met with Dr. George C.D. Kier, a psychiatrist. Dr. Kier wrote in his diagnosis that Dayton manifested pseudo-psychopathic schizophrenia with antisocial traits. Dr. Kier goes on to say there is a strong possibility that the evidence for schizophrenia, as previously suspected, has been in every instance fake, and that this man presents a case of purely sociopathic personality of the antisocial variety. Since the three episodes of assault were also related, at least superficially, to sexual activity, he should also be defined as a sexually dangerous person. It is strongly recommended that Mr. Rogers receive intensive therapy from an inpatient unit and that substantial proof of his cure be demanded by the court prior to his release. Although prosecutors wanted to send Dayton straight to prison, Dayton was found not guilty by reason of insanity and ordered to be committed to Oregon State Hospital in Salem. Dayton was admitted to the hospital on March 6, 1974. While in the hospital, Dayton, like most sociopaths, realized that the only way out of the hospital was to pretend to get better. So pretend he did. However, Dayton was honest at some points and confessed some things in therapy, such as he engaged in occasional light bondage with his wife. He also revealed that he fantasized about raping and hurting women while having sex with his wife, also while masturbating. He stated that the fantasies were better than actual sex. Dayton also admitted that he discovered that tying women up along with violent acts against women sexually aroused him. He had no control over it, no idea where this fantasy came from, and zero understanding as to why this excites him as much as it does, but he said that he enjoys the idea of total control. While in the hospital, his wife filed for divorce, moved away, and ended all contact with Dayton. Dayton was released from the hospital on December 12, 1974. Dayton's family abandoned him for both his crimes and his divorce. Alone, with nowhere to go, Dayton decided to stay in Salem and was able to find work as a house painter rather quickly. He reportedly, even after the hospital stay, was still having violent sexual fantasies. 3 months after being released from the hospital, he met a short, petite, curly-haired brunette named Sherry Miller. Sherry was innocent, sexually naive, pretty, with a clean-cut and loving religious family, and came to Salem from Canobie, Oregon. Shortly after meeting, Dayton and Sherry began dating, but Dayton was not faithful to Sherry and continued to have sexual relations with other women. Only 7 months after meeting, they were married on October 25th, 1975. Just weeks after the wedding, Dayton started cheating again. Apparently, not even a wife and affairs with multiple women could satisfy his dark desires. He took up drinking again, along with smoking marijuana and using amphetamines. Dayton was depressed and on edge most of the time. December 4th, 1975, Sherry questioned Dayton about his nighttime activities. Sherry's seemingly innocent question pushed Dayton over the edge. Angry and unsatisfied, Dayton left that night in his 1967 Malibu. Sherry wouldn't hear from Dayton until the next day, and he would be calling her from jail. Dayton found and smooth-talked an 18-year-old Canobie girl to go for a ride with him, with the promise of alcohol. Dayton instead took her to Barlow Road, tied her up, and raped her. She managed to escape by telling him she needed to use the bathroom. He let her out of the car with her hands still tied together. As soon as she was outside, she took off running down the road. She found a house and pounded on the door. The homeowners were kind enough to let her in and call the police. The police were able to find Dayton rather quickly because he was still on Barlow Road. His car had become stuck in the mud. After being arrested and having his car towed out by the police, Dayton called Sherry to come pick him up. Dayton managed to convince Sherry he had been falsely accused, that it was just a case of mistaken identity. On February 13, 1976, Dayton was indicted on first-degree rape, but was allowed to be free pending a May trial for the Barlow Road rape. February 20th, 1976, a 19-year-old blonde girl was walking towards Salem, leaving the Oregon State Correctional Institute after visiting her boyfriend. She was heading to the Greyhound Depot to get home when a bright yellow 1970 Ford Mustang pulled up beside her, the driver being none other than Dayton. He asked her if she wanted a ride. Wanting to get out of the rain, and he had sweetened the deal with a promise of alcohol and marijuana, she said sure. They pulled off into an abandoned parking lot where they drank, smoked, and listened to music. Eventually, Dayton revealed his true motivation for picking her up and pulled a knife on her. He hog-tied her and cut off all of her clothes. He kissed and bit her feet. He bit her feet so hard that he drew blood. Dayton was preparing to rape her when a car came out of nowhere into the empty parking lot and startled Dayton. He was so shaken up he could not rape her for the fear that he would get caught. Because of his past offenses, along with the new charge pending, he became paranoid and told her he had to kill her. He began heading towards the Malala Forest. Along the drive, this smart, brave young woman managed to convince Dayton to take her to her grandmother's house in Oregon City instead, because no one would be home. She arrived scared, naked, only wearing her jacket, but alive and safe at her grandmother's house. Just 3 days later, on February 23rd, 1976, two young girls aged 15 and 16 were walking to school when a yellow Mustang pulled up and offered them a ride, which they accepted. He had told them his name was Steve Davis. This would become Dayton's alter ego when he picked up other women. He bought them burgers, took them to Cascade Park to watch people fish and drink beer. He then took them to Wheatland Ferry. The girls would say that he seemed friendly and nice. This would soon change. At about 3:30 p.m., Dayton decided it was time to show his true colors. He pulled out a knife. One of the girls stated that the knife had about a 5-inch blade with a brown handle. Dayton then hog-tied them both. Dayton then raped one of the girls while telling the other to look away. After the rape, the girls convinced him that they had to go to the bathroom. And when they got out, they ran away and called their parents, who took them to the police. On May 14, 1976, Dayton was acquitted of rape in the first degree from the Barlow Road incident. According to DA John L. Collins, the reason that Dayton was acquitted for this rape was because if anyone thought the girl somehow contributed, they wouldn't convict someone of rape. In other words, because the girl got into his car and drank with him, it was somehow her contributing. Thankfully, in 2020, the law is no longer this perverse and victim-blaming. On June 25th, 1976, Dayton's probation from the knife attack on the 15-year-old girl was revoked, and Dayton was sentenced to 5 years in prison for probation violation. On August 27th, 1976, Dayton was again acquitted for rape against the two 15 and 16-year-old girls. However, he was convicted of coercion in this case. He subsequently was sentenced to 5 years in prison. A Lane County district judge said, in regards to Dayton, this man is an extreme danger to the community, particularly young women. He is both sexually and physically violent, and without question, is a murder case looking for a place to happen. No one knew just how right this judge would be. Dayton was paroled in 1982, only serving 6 of his 10 years, and 1 year later, his parole was terminated, and he was a free man. Things stayed quiet for 5 years until August 7th, 1987. Dayton went out late at night, having told Sherry he was working late as usual, when truthfully, he left the shop in Woodburn hours before and went to Portland looking for a woman to fulfill his perverse needs. Seeing a blonde near the corner of Union Avenue, he stopped his 1985 light blue Nissan pickup and propositioned the woman working that night, later to be identified as 25-year-old Jennifer Lisa Smith, who had done business with Dayton before and climbed into the truck. It was around 3 a.m. when they pulled into the parking lot of a Denny's restaurant. Shortly after Jennifer and Dayton arrived, witnesses recall hearing muffled screams of a woman in intense pain. A few moments later, the screams became louder, no longer muffled. This is when Jennifer had escaped from the back of the truck and tried to flee. Unfortunately, Dayton caught up to her rather quickly due to the fact she was already gravely injured. Although it was dark, the witnesses could finally see where the screams were coming from. Towards the middle of the parking lot lay a nude woman with a man kneeling over her. At this point, one of the witnesses ran over to Jennifer and Dayton. When Dayton realized that people were approaching, he quickly jumped to his feet and ran in the opposite direction. Upon arriving to Jennifer, they realized the extent of Jennifer's injuries. Her throat had been slashed, and she had multiple stab wounds to her breast, stomach, and back. She was completely covered in blood. One of the witnesses began to perform first aid and CPR on Jennifer, while another ran and called 911. Dayton, foolishly thinking that everyone would be too preoccupied with Jennifer to notice him running back to his truck. However, the witnesses did notice Dayton and knew he was the one who had committed this horrific act against Jennifer. The witnesses, realizing he was trying to get away, blocked off the exits of the parking lot with their own vehicles, but Dayton, desperate to avoid getting caught, drove over the sidewalk. Thinking he had narrowly escaped their trap, Dayton must have felt relieved until he saw a car hot on his trail. One of the witnesses was determined to bring this man down. A chase ensued, reaching speeds over 100 miles per hour. The witness got close enough to get Dayton's license plate and backed off. The witness, having done all that he could, returned to the crime scene and gave the police that had arrived sometime during the chase the information that he had obtained. Jennifer Smith was taken by ambulance to the local hospital, but sadly was pronounced dead on arrival. There were approximately 6 witnesses, and of those, they had all heard her scream for about 2 minutes before her body was found. Police found Jennifer's clothing and one of her shoes close to where her body was found. They also found double-length pair of shoelaces tied together with loops at both ends, leading the police to believe that Jennifer had been hogtied at one point during her time with Dayton. Using registration records, the police tracked down Dayton to the small engine repair business Dayton operated in Woodburn. Upon arriving, the police noticed that Dayton had cut his hand. Dayton initially told the police it was from a hacksaw while working earlier in the evening. Dayton would later change his story about the timing and how he cut his hand several times. The police would also catch Dayton in several other lies about his whereabouts that night. They took Dayton into custody for questioning and received a warrant to search his truck. When police searched Dayton's truck, they found bloodstains along with fingerprints belonging to Jennifer. They later found the bloody knife that was used to kill Jennifer in the bushes next to Dayton's truck at his shop. Witnesses from Denny's were able to positively identify Dayton as the man seen standing over Jennifer. The witnesses who chased him down was also able to identify the vehicle belonging to Dayton as a vehicle the suspect left in and the one he had chased down. The other 5 witnesses were able to point Dayton out of a photo lineup as the man they saw that night standing over Jennifer. One of the officers had a gut feeling that Jennifer was not Dayton's first murder victim. Less than a month later, that gut feeling would prove to be right. Monday, August 31st, 1987, 46-year-old Everett Lee Banyard went bow hunting in the Malala Forest, a regular hobby of his. He was walking deeper into the forest when he smelled a putrid odor and thought someone had gutted a deer and left behind the organs, which wouldn't be uncommon. He kept walking as the smell worsened. Finally, he saw something on the ground. He moved some of the brush out of the way and discovered a human leg. He left the forest immediately and notified the police. It was too dark to search the area that night, but the police set up a guard at the location all night. The following day, the Clackamas County Police would begin a search that would end with the biggest murder case in Oregon history. The first body to be discovered was nude, and she was missing her left foot, which was later found nearby. This was identified as Retha Marie Giles, age 16. The second body to be found was in the fetal position, with both of her feet missing. They were either sawed or cut off at the ankles. Her body was nude as well. She would be identified as Lisa Marie Mock, age 23. The third body was 15 feet north of the first 2 victims, resting against a tree. She had been cut from groin to sternum. She had also had both of her nipples cut off, and her body was nude. She would be identified as Nandis Nani Cervantes, age 26. The fourth body was 40 feet north of victim 3. She had been hidden deep within brush and blackberry vines. She was nude, like the other girls. However, she was mostly skeletal and had clearly been there longer than the others. She would be identified as Cynthia Diane DeVore, age 21. The fifth body found was actively decomposing, partially mummified, 50 yards west of Cynthia. She had been separated from the others. She was nude as well. Her hands were bound behind her back with a dark green 1-inch wide dog collar. Her right foot had also been cut off. She would be identified as Christine Lotus Adams, age 35. The sixth body found was completely skeletal. Only her hair and some rib bones were found. She was unidentified until November of 2013, when DNA testing finally found who she was. She was Tawana Jari Johnson, aged 18. Victim 7 was found 50 feet from number 6. This was Maureen Ann Hodges, age 26. The stab wounds found on the bodies indicated that the murder weapon would be a single-edged knife with the blade 1/2 to 5/8 of an inch across. The evidence found around the area where the victims' bodies were discovered. 1 Regency Sheffield kitchen knife, identical to the one found in the bushes outside Dayton's shop. The same one used to murder Jennifer Smith. This is also believed to be the same type of knife described by the two teen girls during the rape in February of 1976. The knife found near the bodies still had human tissue embedded into it. There was a total of 38 miniature Smirnoff vodka bottles, 34 plastic single-serve orange juice bottles, several items used to tie knots, pantyhose, rope, shoelaces, cloth, and another dog collar. A subsequent search of a wood-burning stove at the Rogers residence turned up parts of women's clothing and jewelry, later identified as belonging to some of the Forest murder victims, as well as metal shoe pieces matching the shoe found near Jennifer's body. 26 prostitutes came forward with experiences with Dayton, all with similar stories of bondage, foot fetish, and him being excessively rough. One woman was even able to lead detectives to the exact site where the victims' bodies had been discovered. She described the location as the last place they had sex. The location where the bodies were found had not been released to anyone outside of the police, so it would be impossible for her to know that was where the bodies had been found. 11 prostitutes who testified during the trial said Rogers usually mixed vodka and orange juice drinks. He always used miniature Smirnoff bottles and single-serve orange juice containers. These are the same type of containers found at the location where the bodies were found. Dayton's first trial for the murder of Jennifer Smith in 1988. Dayton pled not guilty and claimed that it was self-defense, that Jennifer was trying to rob him. Dayton testified on his own behalf. However, Dayton was found guilty and was given a life sentence. Dayton's second trial for the Malala Forest murders. The all-woman jury deliberated a little more than 6 hours before returning with a verdict, guilty of 13 counts of aggravated murder. 3 weeks later, jurors voted for the death by lethal injection. Sherry never testified, never spoke to reporters. However, after Dayton was sentenced to death, Sherry divorced him and moved to a small Oregon town. Because Oregon does not utilize the death penalty, Dayton will spend the rest of his life in prison on death row. Now, as promised, I'm going to read you the letter that I got from Dayton. First, I want to explain to you why I have a letter from Dayton. I wrote to him when I first got the idea for this podcast to kind of get more information on him, as there wasn't really a whole lot out there, and there was so much that was not true and so much that was conflicting and just so much that didn't make sense. And I would rather hear from him himself the truth. So I wrote him this long letter asking a bunch of questions, and I was pretty blunt and to the point because, quite honestly, I didn't really expect him to write me back. However, he did, and so I'm going to read the letter to you. So this is dated 12/31/19. Over the course of time, I've received such mail as yours. I'm sure you are a good people and mean well, but I don't do interviews or assist with agendas for personal gain or exploitation. I'm not a guinea pig for study, as if viewed like a Hannibal Lecter. Having said that, I've always been open for contact with those who genuinely care to befriend me and have each other's best interests at heart. However, your communication had zero in that regard, wherein your letter was solely one-sided in seeking information. I can respect that, and I get it. Yet I'm not who you think I am, nor what you think I am. In spite of what you relied on for your sources of information, at any rate, should you still desire further contact, I'd like to have a phone call with you, if you will. That would provide a better platform than just words on paper. Simply go to and register your cell phone number with our Department of Correction phone provider, and also let me know your number and the best time of day to try calling. With that, I'll leave you on a positive note. If you see someone without a smile, give them yours. After all, a smile is a facelift that's within everyone's price range. Have a joyful new year. May you live long and prosper. Deo. After getting this letter, I honestly felt kind of like a jerk for just asking for information. However, at the same time, I kind of felt creeped out for him asking for my phone number. But at the same time, I think that he makes a really valid point that he's not a guinea pig. He's not something to be studied or to be poked and prodded. But what's interesting is that Dayton has declined any interviews with police, detectives, with lawyers, with anyone really. He's declined them, and the only time he has spoken has been when he spoke on his own behalf in the Jennifer Smith case, and also in 2015 when he apologized for his crimes. Other than that, Dayton won't give interviews. He kind of really closed off, and so for me to even get this letter was a complete shock. But no matter what, he's the one that's alive. And unfortunately, Jennifer Smith, Lisa Mock, Maureen Hodges, Christine Adams, Cynthia DeVore, Nani Cervantes, Retha Gilas, Tawny Johnston are not. And that's the sad part. But at the end of the day, 8 women are gone from the world because of his actions. It's to honor and to remember them and not the killers. Thank you for tuning into this episode. It has been a pleasure to feed your true crime needs. Until next time, this is Columbia saying stay safe.
Thank you for listening to the Pacific Northwest True Crime Podcast. Be sure to check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for pictures from the case, bonus content, and keep up with podcast release info. And remember, Bigfoot isn't the only predator out in the Pacific Northwest. Stay safe out there.